The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, thank you for coming. The goal, what Ellie and I thought that the goal of this talk is to sort of lay the land of some of the issues that Marxists think are central to what causes women's oppression in capitalist society, and then to give a framework also for engaging more specific discussions that are happening throughout the conference about history and social movements and the political debates that we're currently involved in different areas, talks on social reproduction, Me Too, reproductive justice and abortion access, clinic defense, and there's also one on what is gender, the gender binary. So we're gonna try to set up some of that stuff so that if you're, interested in this theme throughout the conference, you can go to these and kind of have the lay of the land. So, okay. And I'm gonna start with the first couple things, then Ellie's gonna take it from there and wrap it up. So in the 1960s and 70s, women got pissed off and they stopped giving a shit. They marched, they occupied women's magazines headquarters, they protested the Miss America pageant, they joined the Black Power movement, they fought for reproductive justice in almost every corner of the country. There are reproductive justice organizations that sparked up in literally every community and demographic that you can imagine. They protested the Vietnam War, they did consciousness raising, and they tried to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Since then, we've been experiencing an enormous cultural shift where women are told that they can aspire to have professional careers, they can be independent, they can have relationships that flout the gender binary, they can have sex with whomever they please. Nonetheless, I was the only self-identified feminist that I knew until I got to college in 2009. Even then, there was a clear divide amongst women between who used the F word to describe themselves and those who did not. Like the other dirty word, the S word, socialism, which you might have noticed has also recently become popular again, along with feminism. Feminism seemed like something nasty for a long time, a word for angry and unattractive women who are unsuccessful in love. But things have, I think, changed. Many of the 3.5 million women who protested against Trump's election on January 19th, 2017, came out to protest again in 2018, with solidarity marches being broadcasted across the world. Women's strikes are being organized annually in several countries. The hashtag MeToo has exposed the pervasive sexual violence that goes on throughout our society, toppling powerful men and powerful institutions, that many of us who have experienced sexual assault never thought possible. Instead of feeling shame and isolation, I think that women have begun yet again to get pissed off. So women's oppression isn't the only history we can tell, nor is it universal throughout time. There are diverse cultural histories as well as histories of courageous fightback, some of which I've mentioned. But I think it's safe to say that 50% of the world's population is in bad shape. So here are some facts that I came across when I was researching what's going on with women in the United States right now. According to the National Organization for Women, NOW is the acronym, and the US Department of Labor, women are paid less than men for the same work and also experience job segregation that places them in low-wage jobs, like in service, sales, and office work, which gets exacerbated when accounting for the racial composition of women in the workforce. In 2015, women worked more than they ever have before, but their labor market participation rate is at 56.7%. The average net wealth of a single black woman, of all single black women as a category, as of 2015 was $5. What this tells you is that they're mostly in water, they're in debt. There are 388 restrictions on abortion access nationwide. According to the RAIN Institute, someone is sexually assaulted in the United States every 98 seconds. 90% of the victims of sexual assault are women. Native American women are twice as likely as every other racial group to experience rape in their lifetime. 1 in 2 single black mothers live in poverty, compared to 1 in 3 single white mothers. The National Institute of Health claims that more than half of all women in high school say that they are trying to lose weight, with some demographics being closer to 70%. Due to the rise of opioid abuse, the mortality rate of white women has declined for the first time in several decades. This fact is relevant because white women have a historically stable mortality rate and they live even longer than white men. So I think we're in a social crisis that is not new. And there's a way in which I think sometimes the mainstream media can make it seem like it's the apocalypse on women and we're like waiting for the downfall of Roe v. Wade and so on and so forth. But I think for most women, working class women in our society, they've been living in those conditions for a long time. So this crisis is pervasive. Not only are we in bad shape, we are divided in seemingly inexhaustible ways. Some people even doubt that the category of women is a useful one or even a real one. Women are irreducibly separated by race, sexuality, whether you fit into the gender binary, geographic location, class, and so on and so forth. Honestly, this list is endless. We might ask why we bother when we have other groups to struggle with, struggles that exceed the boundaries of womanhood, whatever that is, that might get us some rights faster along other axes. In my view, these are serious problems and complex theoretical issues. I'm not going to solve all of the political problems that are evident in raising these questions, but I am going to start this talk off with charting a course through which I think we can start talking them through. I want to start with the idea that Marxists are social constructionists. Social construction is a word that gets thrown out a lot about race, gender, ethnicity, and sexuality, among others. So I think we should explain it a little bit, or at least what it's arguing against. So I think that there's no better person to help illustrate what's at stake in clarifying this issue than the French philosopher Simone de Beauvoir. Even if you don't like fuck with existentialism, I think it's worth opening The Second Sex and giving it a read because kind of no matter what, Simone de Beauvoir is a boss-ass bitch philosopher. So in 1949, de Beauvoir wrote the following to introduce The Second Sex. And I think it resonates a lot with some of my own historically feelings about writing about feminism and about women's issues. For a long time, she says, I have hesitated to write a book on women. The subject is irritating, especially to women, and it's not new. Enough ink has been spilled in quarreling over feminism, and perhaps we should say no more about it. It is still talked about, however, for the voluminous nonsense uttered during the last century seems to have done little to illuminate the problem. After all, is there a problem? And if so, what is it? Are there women, really? And later she writes, but first we must ask, what is a woman? Some say woman is a womb. But in speaking of certain women, connoisseurs declare that they are not women, although they are equipped with a uterus like the rest. All agree in recognizing the fact that females exist in the human species. Today, as always, they make up about one half of humanity. And yet we are told that femininity is in danger. We are extorted to be women, remain women, become women. It would appear then that every female human being is not necessarily a woman. To be so considered, she must share in that mysterious and threatened reality known as femininity. Is this attribute something secreted by the ovaries, or is it a platonic essence? A product of the philosophic imagination? Is it a rustling petticoat enough to bring it down to earth? Although some women try zealously to incarnate this essence, it is hardly patentable. It is frequently described in vague and dazzling terms that seem to have been borrowed from the vocabulary of the seers, and indeed in the times of St. Thomas, it was considered an essence as certainly defined as the somniferous virtue of the poppy. What conservative discourse would have us believe is that women are natural beings, and that the gender binary, the gender division of labor, and our social norms around sex are all right and proper because reproductive body parts secrete a mystical feminine essence that makes white people who can get pregnant better caregivers with delicate sensibilities. Black people with these reproductive parts are dangerous, seductive, lascivious, too independent and angry, having feminine essence distorted by blackness. Lesbians aren't real women either. They can't be bothered to have the right kind of reproductive sex, so femininity doesn't ooze from their bodies as nicely, and so on and so forth. The conservative worldview in its many incarnations goes on, naturalizing the social problems that need to be explained so as to justify them. De Beauvoir later utters her famous words, "One is not born, but rather becomes a woman." This is what feminists of many stripes think. And I think it's also what Marxists think. Womanhood is a social and political situation, so it's constructed by a historical process. It's not a natural fact. Ovaries might help to make babies, but always and everywhere they do so in a social context that politicizes and socializes the process of baby making. But where do we go from here? Okay, so people often say, oh, it's socially constructed. A lot of things are. And it seems like it's a criticism when people say that. But just because something is socially constructed doesn't make it wrong. Social construction is true about many parts of our lives, some of which I've mentioned. What we really want to know is what aspects of our social lives contribute to constructing this person called woman, and why that process oppresses those of us who become women with varying degrees of success, fail to be women, as well as those who aren't women at all. A Marxist approach to explaining women's oppression starts by asking about the material conditions of their lives. This approach has two goals. First, to explain the structures in our society that produce and reproduce women's oppression and that pose concrete obstacles to women's liberation. Second, to explain what it would take to end those conditions and create new conditions in which women's liberation is possible. So here's the spoiler. Marxists think that women's liberation is possible and that it would take a revolution against capitalism to make that happen. Not only do we think it's possible, we also think it's necessary for human emancipation. The point is, in the words of Russian revolutionary Inessa Armand, if women's liberation is unthinkable without communism, communism is unthinkable without women's liberation. Okay. So the liberal organization, the national that I mentioned, now the National Organization for Women, gives the following statistics about women in the labor market. I'm going to talk a little bit about the famous pay gap and the relationship of poverty and women's poverty within the capitalist labor market. I often find that the first thing that people notice is like women make less money than men, and people want to know why. And I think it's interesting to see how like Now explains this or tries to, and I think compare it to a Marxist analysis. So Now gives the following statistics about women in the labor market. For every child a woman has, she suffers a 5% wage penalty. A study done by the American Association of University Women, and Now cites, found that within 10 years of graduating from universities, 23% of mothers had left the workforce compared to 1% of fathers. Professors at Cornell University estimated that a third of the gap in labor force participation of women compared to men is a result of poor family leave and little workplace flexibility. And you know, this is also in the face of the context in which we're all supposedly living in a gig economy where we can escape the drudgery of like going to work every day and working long shitty hours, and we can now make our own schedules and work from home. So the statistics about women are sort of a challenge to that, I think. A study done by the University of Massachusetts in 2010 found that fathers in the United States earn 11% more than non-fathers. Okay, so these penalties that women face when they become mothers are the reverse for fathers. In contrast, employers are less likely to hire women with children than those without women or without children. If employers do choose to hire a mother, employers offer a lower salary than they do to other women. All of this produces the famous gender wage gap. In aggregate, women make 23 cents less than men for each dollar they earn, and like some websites will say it's 21, whatever. And women of color have a wider gap than white women. The gender wage gap decreased for decades after women entered the workforce en masse, but has stalled for the past 10 years. So it was kind of building up, and since the 2008 crisis, it has that has ceased to improve. If we control for education and experience, the gap remains, although unions help negotiate it in some sectors of the workforce. Where unions are not present, labor markets are more segregated by gender. There are also cultural issues that influence the labor market. Male employers are less likely to hire women who bargain for wages because they consider these women demanding. Pregnant women are portrayed as less committed to work and less reliable. Now says that women with children are punished with the motherhood penalty. And I think this is as good a turn of phrase as any to describe the situation. But this is what the US Department of Labor has to say after finding similar conclusions in their publication on explaining the gender wage gap. Okay, they say, and this is a quote, "This is not an exhaustive list of issues and things that impact the labor market. And some causes for the wage gap remain unexplained by existing research. For example, gender discrimination may be responsible for some portion of the unexplained wage gap. However, these are some of the major factors that have been barriers to women's earning potential and pay equality. And there is more to the story. Women of color continue to face significant racial wage gaps on top of the gender wage gap. So they like restate their conclusions, but they're kind of puzzled, right? Because women can go to work, they're the kind of structural institutional obstacles and cultural contexts in which women couldn't work seem different now. So it's interesting that the analysis stops there. And I think that what these statistics don't explain is why having babies and or being mothers is such an issue in the capitalist labor market. So I'm not going to argue that having children condemns women to particular roles. I think that's a conservative argument. What I am arguing is that the social context in which child rearing happens under capitalism, which is a necessary part of human life, is hostile to people who have children being able to flourish in capitalist societies. And historically, these are women. Capitalism organizes labor through the market. Capitalist markets are unique because, for the most part, people have to look for work with private employers. So at the moment, private landowners own 61% of the land in the United States, the federal government 23%, state and local governments 9%, Native Americans 2%. Okay, so that's like all to say that people who need to work for a living are not self-sufficient because they have no property. They have to go to work for people who do own property and compete with other individuals for these scarce jobs. The labor market never fully absorbs everyone who wants to work. And you know, if you talk to an economist or you read anything about economics to the extent you can like understand it, you'll find that economists are cool with this, and they anticipate, even under the best of circumstances, a necessary unemployment rate to keep like the workplace competition going. So they think it's like 4% is chill. Women have a historically volatile relationship with the labor market. Women have to leave the labor market for periods of time to give birth. When they can re-enter the labor market, they are rehired at wages that are lower than the ones paid to men because employers are aware that they're not as reliable. This is used against them. So the periodic absence of women from the workplace also means that when women compete for jobs as individuals, they are viewed as competing for men's jobs, who, in general, are on the labor market for longer periods of time and often more consistently. This structure of competition is a self-reinforcing structure. Men view women as competitors. They also have to compete to maintain households in the periods where they need to care for their spouses and partners economically. In this way, the logic of competition divides and conquers the working class by excluding women from some kinds of work and creating a gendered division of labor. Instead of an evenly distributed co-ed labor market, we have women's work in industries of agriculture, care work, nursing, teaching, child care, housekeeping, and so on. These are uncoincidentally industries with low levels of labor productivity where wages increase less quickly. The cultural and ideological justifications for what makes these jobs women's work are no different in nature today than the mystical belief in what makes women feminine in a good Victorian novel. Women are more caring, women are less competitive by nature, women inherently want to sacrifice themselves for others and for their family, etc. Even though people spend most of their waking hours at work, capitalism isn't just about going to work. It's about reproducing a form of life around a type of work relationship. It's not just individual women who respond to these conditions, it's whole households and family networks. Marxists use the word social reproduction to talk about how we have to reproduce life under capitalism. Workers produce things for their bosses, whether these be goods or services, but the workers themselves need to be educated, socialized, and cared for as they grow, develop, and make their own families. So Johanna Brenner and Barbara Lazlett are Marxist sociologists, and they put it this way. Social reproduction includes, and this is a quote, how food, clothing, and shelter are made available for immediate consumption, the ways in which the care and socialization of children are provided, the care of the infirm and elderly, and the social organization of sexuality. So socialist feminists have often used the concept of reproductive labor to describe the multifaceted dimensions of this work, which is simultaneously mental, manual, and emotional, and necessary. Capitalism privatizes reproductive labor, which means that all of the responsibilities of creating and maintaining life fall on the shoulders of private households. So, you know, all things being equal, your boss has 0% desire to contribute to healthcare, childcare, maternity leave, family leave, education, and so on. Paying for these services, whether they take place within companies or through public institutions through taxes, eats into profits. Just as important as eating into profits, though, is eating into the unilateral rights to owning private property that our legal system takes for granted. The fact that capitalists own the places where we work, the production process, the raw materials, and the technology that we work with, gives them de facto rights to control all of the decisions about how they use these resources. It's important for their ability to compete on the market that they do not lose control over this labor process. So making them pay for childcare at work, for example, is something they will fight to maintain both profits and control. Those things are interrelated. Okay, I'll be a couple more minutes. Where was I? The result of all of this is that the private and domestic sphere gets separated out from work. This division between production and reproduction, work and domesticity, is peculiar to capitalism and disproportionately affects women and how it distributes burdens. It is also shaped by class differences and is highly racialized. Working class women differ from bourgeois women, ruling class women, middle class women, in what they can and cannot do. They also experience different kinds of social exclusion. Working class women of color and women who are immigrants also face different kinds of constraints and exclusions compared to white women. Immigration status, housing segregation, and racist policing make an enormous difference to how family structures emerge in response to these social conditions. For example, black women have historically high rates of labor market participation compared to white women, and have higher rates of being primary breadwinners in their families. One cause for this is that black men experience intense racial discrimination on the job market and can keep stable jobs with less frequency than white men who are also working class. High rates of incarceration in working class communities of color exacerbate this volatile relationship to work. Being incarcerated forcibly takes people out of the labor market and makes it difficult or impossible to reenter it. Racial divisions among working class women are not unrelated, however. Black women are targeted by ruling class attempts to destroy social reforms and also ideologically by the right wing. They are welfare queens and threats to good jobs through affirmative action. These attacks on black women provide a racist ideological cover for attacks on social services that help low-income families. Poverty and black women become so synonymous that people are shocked to find out that the most common recipient of welfare is a single white mother for a period of 1 to 2 years. Black women are targeted by attacks on these public programs and are disproportionately affected by lack of access to them, and these are also attacks on all low-income women, and I think both can be true at the same time. How we understand the different but connected problems that revolve around social reproduction can have important political consequences on the kinds of struggles that develop and that become possible, and whether or not solidarity across difference can take place. I think that's what's important about this analysis is that it shows why the fate of the whole working class, not just women or even one group of women, is implicated in these struggles, even if some women carry incommensurate burdens compared to others. So I'm going to turn it over to Ellie, my good friend.
Hello, can people hear me? Okay. So I'm going to pick up where Lily left off. So the Me Too movement is an example of how inequality and segregation in the workplace affects all women across lines of race and sexuality, sometimes in ways that are similar and sometimes in ways that are very different. So although Me Too was actually founded by black Harlem-based activist Tarana Burke 10 years ago, it really started gaining steam in October of 2017 when Hollywood actresses publicly described the systematic sexual abuse that they endured at the hands of powerful men in the industry and encouraged others to share their own stories. It is true that famous, wealthy, mostly white, mostly cisgendered and straight actresses experience oppression differently than most other women, and that they have a number of advantages compared to, say, agricultural or hospitality workers who experience harassment and assault on the job. It is also true that the violence and oppression that Hollywood actors experience at the hands of men, who in many cases could make or break their careers, has a lot in common with the kinds of oppression other women experience on the job. In any case, the movement quickly spread beyond Hollywood as ordinary people around the world began to find the courage to say, "Me too." So millions of people are standing up against rape, assault, and abuse carried out by bosses, coworkers, partners, acquaintances, and strangers. Survivors have publicly accused 219 celebrities, CEOs, and politicians for rape, assault, and abuse carried out since April 2017. And these men have finally experienced some consequences for decades of predatory behavior. But to give you an idea of the extent of sexual violence in the workplace, here's just a few statistics that I learned from a talk by Sharon Smith about the Me Too movement. So 3 in 10 women have to put up with unwanted advances from male coworkers. Among women who have been subjected to sexual violence in the workplace, 95% say male perpetrators usually go unpunished. 80% of women restaurant workers experience sexual harassment from customers, 2/3 from managers, and 1/2 from coworkers. 80% of hotel workers also experience sexual violence on the job. Women workers in the janitorial industry, who are disproportionately women of color and 70% of whom are undocumented, also face staggering levels of harassment, assault, and rape. The systematic sexual abuse of women has always been a regular feature of capitalism, and part of what the Me Too movement has done is to shine a light on just how much of the sexual abuse is wrapped up in the exploitation of women's labor. When we are looking at the prevalence of sexual assault and harassment in the workplace, we need to understand first what kind of position women are in the workplace overall. So as Lily mentioned, individual women are seen as responsible for the safety and well-being of their children in ways that men are not, and in ways that society as a whole certainly is not. So women can even go to prison and lose custody of their children, aka forced family separation and all the trauma and grief that it entails, if they fail to provide them with everything they need. So women overall need to hold on to jobs in ways that men don't always. Moreover, Lily already described the ways that women are paid less than men, and this inequality is further stratified by race, as well as the way in which women's occupational opportunities are limited by capitalism in the form of a gender division of labor. So in a situation where women are vulnerable and afraid to speak out against their abuser because they might have their means of survival taken away with very few options available to them, they're often silenced and ignored by a justice system that overwhelmingly sides with rich and powerful men. In fact, sexual and gender-based violence are extremely common within the criminal justice system. Cops are 4 times more likely than the general population to be domestic abusers. Cops also forcibly and routinely strip, assault, and rape people in their custody, as in the case of teenager Anna Chambers, who the cops arrested and raped in the back of their van and then tried to claim that she wanted it by writing her off as a slut. Moreover, at least 80,600 people experience sexual violence while incarcerated each and every year, and the majority of prison rapes are perpetrated by guards, not by fellow inmates. This is not even counting forced strip searches and cavity searches, which are a routine, perfectly legal form of state-sponsored sexual violence experienced by the vast majority of incarcerated people, which is not a negligible number in a country where 1 in 10 people and 1 in 3 black men will spend time in prison or jail in their lifetime. Incidentally, even as the extremely high incarceration rate in this country has more or less plateaued in the last few years, the incarceration rate for women continues to rise quickly, and Native American women are incarcerated at 6 times the rate of white women. The worker-boss relationship that forms modern conditions of capitalist exploitation converges with sexual abuse at the most fundamental level. The unequal relationship between them is reinforced by the fact that sexist bosses control the conditions of women's employment. In a way that mirrors Marx's account of the alienation of the worker, a woman in the workplace will often have to endure the sexual advances of her boss in a way that make her lose the sense of control over her own body, like the worker who sells their labor power to a boss who commands them in all aspects of their labor. The Me Too movement has made huge strides toward stigmatizing rape survivors and allowing their voices to be heard and believed. If the gains from the movement are to be sustained, however, we have to tackle these underlying issues that erect obstacles for safe and fair workplaces. We need for more unions to take up women's liberation in general and sexual violence in particular as central to their struggles to win a better workplace. We need to continue shedding light on rampant abuse and impunity in various industries and keep bringing the struggle into the streets and into workplaces, schools, neighborhoods, and anywhere else that sexual violence takes place. So reproductive justice is another area in which women often lose control of our own bodies. Generally, when people talk about reproductive justice, they're talking about people's rights to determine their own reproductive destinies, to have as many or as few children as they like and on their own terms. This includes access to contraceptives and abortion if one chooses, as well as the right not to use contraceptives or to be sterilized if one chooses. Letting people reproduce according to their own wishes and life plan is a fairly simple demand, yet these rights seem to be under constant attack. This is because the way society is organized and the way reproduction is organized must go hand in hand. As long as one class controls society, they must assert control over reproduction as well. We can find evidence for this idea as far back as Aristotle. So in Politics from 350 BCE, Aristotle lays out a number of recommendations for the state to ensure that its population is the right size, that its citizens develop morally and intellectually in a desirable way, desirable as determined by a wealthy ruling class white male philosopher, and that they have the material conditions required to live leisurely and virtuous lives. He's talking about other ruling class people here. So he lays out his specific recommendations for marriage and reproduction with the aim of creating a population that is neither too big nor too small to be governed effectively, and rearing youth that will be ideal citizens. He says, for example, that women should marry at the age of 18, men should marry at the age of 37, that they should marry in winter and start having children immediately, and that they should stop reproducing when the husband is 54 years old. This is so that parents can bear children in the prime of their life, the children can be healthy, and the parents can live to see their children become successful in adulthood. But the ultimate aim is creating healthy and virtuous citizens. Aristotle is clear that citizens beget and bear offspring for the state. He also specifies that legislators should require pregnant women to exercise daily, and that they should punish adulterers severely. He recommends mandated abortion for couples with too many children, but is opposed to infanticide, except in cases of what he deems deformed children. So in other words, it's not new for ruling classes to be concerned with controlling women's reproduction in order to control the state's demographics. With the rise of the modern capitalist state, this trend is certainly continued. For example, in colonial North America, European settlers originally traced children's lineage through the patriline. So you are your father's child, and he is his father's child, and so on and so forth. However, when slavery became the basis of the Southern economy, and when it became economically and politically important to keep generations of people enslaved, the ruling class quickly changed the law. The legal doctrine of partus sequitur ventrum, or progeny follows the womb, bound racial slavery to maternal identity. So a child born because a slave's owner raped her became legally her child and therefore his property to be enslaved, traded, and sold at his whim. There's that forced family separation again. This also gave slave owners not only the ability to rape with impunity, but also economic incentive to do so, as they could accumulate property that way. The rest of U.S. history is littered with brutal examples of ruling class control of reproduction, such as the forced sterilization of Puerto Rican women and forced sterilizations of other women of color and people with disabilities, happening on a systematic level through the 1970s, while white women who wanted sterilizations were denied access to them during the same period. These attacks are always carried out under the banner of racist, sexist, classist, and ableist ideology. For example, demonizing black and Latina women respectively for having so-called crack babies and anchor babies that will burden the system. Today, one of the main battle lines for reproductive justice is the defense of our abortion clinics. Abortion is a fundamental right that allows women to control our own bodies and our own futures. However, this right is under serious attack and in danger of being taken away completely. Whatever slimy, misogynist troll Trump appoints and the Democrats confirm for the Supreme Court, I can guarantee you he will be hostile to abortion rights. The Republicans have made it clear that they are out to kill Roe v. Wade, and the Democrats have made it clear that they aren't especially interested in defending abortion rights. Ask if the Democrats were right to allow people who are openly against abortion rights to campaign as Democrats and to devote significant resources to get them elected. Nancy Pelosi responded that, quote, of course the party should embrace anti-choicers. She even blamed Trump's victory on Democrats defending abortion rights, which is funny because they don't actually do that. So already this political situation has led to a very serious erosion of abortion rights. The right wing's main strategy has been to restrict access to abortion as much as possible on the path to all-out criminalization. So since 2011, over 400 new abortion restrictions were passed at the state level. Seven states have only one abortion clinic, while some women from rural areas have to travel literally hundreds of miles to get an abortion. Add to that the 1976 Hyde Amendment, which says that federal funds cannot be used for abortions, and you have a situation where many, many women cannot afford the money or the time to travel away from home for a surgical procedure that itself costs about $500. We should be realistic about what happens when women don't have access to safe and legal abortions. The alternative that the right wants, which is an alternative of forced pregnancy and forced birth, would be horrific enough. But in reality, if a woman needs an abortion, she'll do what she has to do to get one. So according to a study by OBGYN's Lisa Haddad and Nawal Noor, every year worldwide, about 42 million women with unintended pregnancies choose abortion, and nearly half of those procedures, 20 million, are unsafe. Some 68,000 women die of unsafe abortion annually, making it one of the leading causes of maternal mortality. Of women who survive unsafe abortion, 5 million will suffer long-term health complications. So that's a woman dying every 8 minutes from an unsafe abortion. Planned Parenthood and already, you know, worldwide. Planned Parenthood and the other liberal forces more or less limit their activist defense to A, downplaying abortion by saying that they provide mammograms and pap smears and whatever, and by B, encouraging people to vote for Democrats. Planned Parenthood even goes so far as to actively discourage people from doing clinic defense work, that is, showing up at clinics to defend patients and workers against the right-wing bigots that periodically descend to harass them. Clearly, the dominant liberal strategy is anemic at best. What we need, and what many people across the country are already building, is an unapologetic and active defense of abortion as such, and a mass movement capable of throwing a wrench in the ascendant Handmaid's Tale dystopian dream world of the right. We also need an abortion rights movement that is confident in its defense of trans and queer people and women of color. Abortion is far from being a straight white women's issue as it is often made out to be. Lastly, before I move on, I want to mention that I see the cruelty of borders as a reproductive justice issue. People have a right to care and provide for their children, and that right is taken away when families are literally torn apart. In one case, a Guatemalan woman named Beata Mariana de Jesus Mejia Mejia, her husband threatened to kill her and her 7-year-old son, prompting her to flee to the United States in search of asylum. However, Border Patrol agents took her son away, and he was then given up for permanent adoption to a white couple as his mother continued to search desperately for him. Earlier this week, Beata finally won her lawsuit to be reunited with her son, but many thousands of immigrants still don't have any idea where their children are or what has become of them. In an interview with the Huffington Post, immigration lawyer Jody Goodwin describes how her clients are unable to prepare for or win their own asylum cases because they're too heartbroken over the loss of their children. Crying herself, Goodwin says, quote, "They are losing it. They are red-faced and have bloodshot eyes, and all they do is cry. We are trying to ask them basic information, but they are whimpering and they can't talk. We are having to hug them and hold them tight and try to give them some kind of comfort." Keeping families together and out of cages is a reproductive justice demand and one that all feminists should be fighting for. Before I conclude, I want to move on to talk a little bit about the gender binary, which is something that Lily brought up, but that I'd like to explore in a little more detail. So the gender binary is bullshit. Why on earth would having two X chromosomes make you want to shave your armpits, right? But at the same time, we are all the fish and the gender binary is the water. It is all around us quietly and sometimes loudly shaping virtually everything we do, see, hear, think, and feel. The gender binary is an ideology. I want to take time to suss out this term ideology and what it means, because I think it could mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So let's turn to Barbara Field's amazing article, Slavery, Race, and Ideology in the United States of America. Quick plug, if you have not read this article, please do Google it. You can get a free PDF. It's brilliant. So here's how Fields describes what an ideology is not, and I'll quote here at some length. "It is not a material entity, a thing of any sort that you can hand down like an old garment, pass on like a germ, spread like a rumor, or impose like a code of dress or etiquette. Nor is it a collection of dissociated beliefs or attitudes. Nor is it a Frankenstein's monster that takes on a life of its own. Ideology is not the same as propaganda. Someone who said anti-slavery ideology infiltrated the slave quarters through illicit abolitionist newspapers would be talking rather about propaganda than about ideology. The slaves' anti-slavery ideology could not be smuggled to them in alien newsprint. People deduce and verify their own ideology in daily life. An ideology is, again in Field's words, quote, "the descriptive vocabulary of day-to-day existence through which people make a rough sense of the social reality that they live and create from day to day. It is the language of consciousness that suits the particular way in which people deal with their fellows. It is the interpretation and thought of the social relations through which they constantly create and recreate their collective being in all the varied forms their collective being may assume. As such, ideologies are not delusions but real as the social relations for which they stand. As such, ideologies are not delusions. Oh, sorry. Ideologies are real, but it does not follow that they are scientifically accurate or that they provide an analysis of social relations that would make sense to anyone who does not take ritual part in those social relations. So in other words, people make and do ideology all the time in everyday life rather than just receiving it from on high through the media, etc., although that does tend to reinforce dominant ideologies. So rather than like we have fucked up ideas and therefore we live in a fucked up world, it goes backward. Like the world around us is organized in a really fucked up way, and people work backward from that to deduce ideologies. So the gender binary provides a very clear example of how ideology works. There's nothing scientific about it. There's no difference between men's and women's brains. Instead, from the time we are fetuses, we are surrounded by the ideology of the binary. If you've ever been visibly pregnant, you know that total strangers constantly ask you, boy or girl. Most baby showers are totally saturated with gender, and you know, how else would you know whether to bring a pink or a blue onesie as your gift? And if that's not enough, many people have gender reveal parties with such ridiculous themes as guns or glitter, sparkles or sports, and my favorite, cupcake or stud muffin. If ideologies are a way that we make sense of our collective social map, then there are conditions within our social reality that continue to make that map seem like it's reasonable and natural, like the gender division of labor and the segregated labor market. So earlier in the talk, Lily described how the idea of femininity justifies these social conditions to make them seem natural. The gender binary as a whole works in a similar kind of ideological way. But as Fields reminds us, the fact that the gender binary is so ubiquitous and so much a part of life as to seem completely natural does not mean that it is scientific or true. We know that one's genitalia does not determine one's gender, for example, yet parents feel confident saying that their child is a boy or a girl based only on an ultrasound image. They don't actually know their child's gender until the child is old enough to decide for themselves, and even then, gender identity and expression can change throughout a person's life. So many social scientists make the distinction between sex and gender to explain this, in which sex is biological and gender is cultural. But even though sex is meant to describe biology, it's a cultural ideology as well. The Intersex Campaign for Equality estimates that 1.7% of people are born intersex, meaning that they have some biological features that are considered male and others that are considered female. In other words, intersex people are about as common as redheads, but they are rendered almost completely invisible because such is their potential to destabilize the ideas about the binary nature of sex that our capitalist society posits as natural and fundamental. Many intersex babies and children undergo surgery and medical treatments that they are unable to consent to in order to quote unquote correct their condition. Some of these treatments are medically necessary, but many are not. Many intersex people are out and proud, but many deal with shame, stigma, silence, and secrecy throughout their lives. In other words, our society goes to great lengths, including physically cutting people up and sewing them back together different to maintain the myth of the sex binary from which the gender binary is supposed to flow naturally. So nobody perfectly fits into the sexual binary. Men have breast tissue, women grow facial hair, men and women alike have monthly hormonal cycles. But when one diverges enough from the sexual binary, one is socially punished and sanctioned. The same is true of the gender binary. You know, I can say confidently that no one in this room knows anyone that perfectly lives up to the insane standards of masculinity or femininity. To do so is impossible, for one, because masculinity and femininity contain many impossible contradictions, like the pressure on women to walk that perfect tightrope between prude and slut, which is a task designed for failure. But when people diverge enough from the gender binary, or when they refuse altogether to conform to it, they too are socially sanctioned and punished, sometimes viciously. Police used to routinely raid gay and lesbian bars and round up butch women, femme men, drag queens and kings, and anyone they saw as gender nonconforming. They would beat them, rape them, and haul them away to jail where they would be tortured. I highly recommend Leslie Feinberg's novel Stone Butch Blues, in which the protagonist Jess Goldberg narrates her life as a butch, he/she, and how her life is shaped by the ever-present threat and reality of punitive violence for failing to conform to the gender binary. I believe that book is in the Haymarket Book Room, but fun fact, you can just Google it and there's a free PDF online. Intersex, gender non-binary, and especially trans activists have done a tremendous amount to change this dynamic, destabilize the binary, and carve out a social place for themselves in recent years. Even in the last decade, they made tremendous progress toward visibility and recognition of their humanity. There are now parenting books and support groups for parents of trans children, widespread recognition among LGBT people of the foundational role of trans people in all of our struggles, and some trans celebrities and advocates who are household names. But punitive violence remains present as a threat and reality for trans and genderqueer people. Finally, to conclude, I want to share some thoughts about how we can build a world free of sexism. Lily and I both gestured to some ways that men too are harmed by sexism, as it divides the working class and tries to bind all of us through gender to a very narrow slice of what humanity can be when freed through from capitalism. The fight back must be for all of our freedom, and it must be multigendered, multiracial, and actively opposed to all forms of oppression. Only by ending capitalism and creating a socialist society can we build a world free from sexism. Socialist organization will be crucial to building and supporting these fights and bringing them to the next step toward revolution. It will be crucial in bringing the lessons of the past to the present. It will be crucial in building bridges between and among movements, and it will be crucial to our victory. So if you're not yet a member of a socialist organization, I strongly recommend that before this conference is over, you make a trip to the recruitment table by the Haymarket Book Room and sign yourself a little red card.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.